This is James Taylor, who used to be popular doing 18th century music. Or in this case, 19th century. Oh, I don't want to play. This still. I haven't heard the bell yet.
Yeah, it went.
Oh, okay. How many of you, and now I know you are too much for this part of it, so the three pieces I've been playing are tunes that would have come or been played by both Confederates and Northern armies. And at the end of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln asked that Dixie be played. Why? Well, it turns out he recognized two tunes. One was Dixie and the other wasn't. I don't know if it was tone deaf or what, but he didn't know. So, as I said in front of John Adams, now I'm really up a creek because I really don't have any music for Woodrow Wilson tomorrow. I hope I'm going to do what the blurb said I was going to do, or what they announced at dinner. If I don't, it's going to be close, and hopefully you'll get something out of it. Jerry has been very gracious in finding sound equipment, and what I'd like to do is just play a little snippet, 3 minutes and 34 seconds from Ashokan Farewell, that's been put to a letter. It's from part one of the Civil War series with Ken Burns. And if you don't know the story of the letter, Ken Burns was out doing his thing. And a family in Rhode Island heard about this. And one of the great things about that series is all the primary documents that came in. And this family found this letter. And it's a very moving, if you see the first hour, you almost cry at the end. Go on in. I'd like you to listen to it, because it encapsulates not just love, but a new type of love that's emerging in the 19th century, and new concepts about heaven and about what's going to happen. And this is one of the things that the Civil War is going to change and Lincoln is going to wrestle with. All right, so this is the added bonus, if you will.
A week before the Battle of Bull Run, Sullivan Ballou, a major in the 2nd Rhode Island Volunteers, wrote home to his wife in Smithfield. July the 14th, 1861, Washington, D.C. Dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. And lest I should not be able to write you again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eye when I'm no more. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how American civilization now leans upon the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the Revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly with all those chains to the battlefield. The memory of all the blissful moments I've enjoyed with you come crowding over me, and I feel most deeply grateful to God and you that I've enjoyed them for so long. how hard it is for me to give them up and burn to ashes the hopes of future years. When God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and see our boys grown up to honorable manhood around us. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults and the many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have sometimes been. But oh, Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love, I shall always be with you in the brightest day and the darkest night. Always. Always. And when the soft breeze fans your cheek, it shall be my breath, or the cool air of your throbbing temple, it shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone, and wait for me, for we shall meet again.
Sullivan Ballou was killed a week later at the First Battle of Bull Run.
All right, so what'd you hear just in that little snippet?
Ashokan farewell.
The musician, yeah. For those that came in late, I'd ask, listen to the words.
The notion of afterlife.
Notion of an afterlife. Let's take it a step further, though.
That you can even come back and be with me.
Come back. This is going to be a time where marriage is beginning to be transformed, where marriage involves the afterlife. Up until the 19th century, marriage was of this world, not involved with the next world as well. So when he articulates this notion that you will, you know, I'm on your breath, I'm this, and we'll meet again, that is a brand new notion of marriage that's emerging, that he's articulating. What else?
Love of country exceeds even love of spouse.
Love of country takes precedence. We have another chair. She's got to do her spinning at the same time. So love of country trumps love of spouse or obligation to country. What did he equate? Now remember, he dies at the very first Eastern battle. I know those from Virginia, New York, and elsewhere say the battle was the first battle of the Civil War. That's nonsense. Okay? That's East Coast bias. First major battle on the Eastern Front. So this is the very beginning. But what has he equated the endeavor to?
The revolutionary.
Exactly right. The American Revolution. And so he is beginning to, and he articulates before many, that he has placed himself in as savior of the nation. He has placed himself above family. And this is going to become a motif that will emerge as we go through the Civil War. That is, we are doing God's work in saving the Union. That what I am doing has greater value than just me. And that in protecting or in creating or keeping this nation together, God is on my side. So it's a without him articulating, without him saying, here's what I'm doing, right? The more one can think about these ideas in just that 3-minute little letter, and it's a lovely letter, you get some ideas. Now, for those that came in late, I hope I'm going to do what Andre said I was going to do, or what I said I was going to do 2 weeks ago. But we'll try it. This is Abraham Lincoln's comment to a friend, right? Take all of this book upon reason. That, Adams, Jefferson, right? Reason is what's going to lead us there. That you can. And the balance on faith. and you will live and die a happier and better man. He doesn't say, and believe it. But what we're going to get, and this is the point I want to make here, is unlike Adams and Jefferson, who kind of couldn't deal with the faith side of it, Lincoln is going to be far more comfortable in accepting what is unknowable or what is unprovable. And one of the reasons for that will be the catastrophe of the Civil War. And I'm not talking about winners and losers. I'm talking about the loss of life, how it transforms society. All right? So with that, for those, this is history, so I always have a quick background. Sometimes it's not so quick, but I hope. Let's make some continuity. Like Adams, like Jefferson, Lincoln comes of age during a religious revival. All right? It is incredibly hardcore. It's called the Second Great Awakening. And it's going to split the nation. And it's going to split the nation. As soon as you ask these questions, you know what happens? No one wants to raise their name. They're all embarrassed. Any Baptist in the room?
Unlikely.
Well, is that orthodoxy or orthopraxy that we're going
to... American Baptist.
Okay, we'll come to it. You'll see it just now. But it's particularly strong in border areas like Kentucky, like southern Illinois, southern Indiana, southern Ohio. All right? It strikes first in the rural areas.
I gotta be difficult. Did they think of themselves as border areas at that time?
No.
Okay, so no. That's a post...
Yeah.
Okay.
He also grows up during what we call the Age of Jackson. In 100 years, it's gonna be the Age of Reagan. And Ronald Reagan will be treated exactly the same way. It's a dominant figure. People loved him or hated him. That's what makes it simple. But the Age of Jackson is also called the Age of the Common Man. And the notion that emerges was that any man, and it is man, can do any job. Right? If Jackson, this orphaned kid, can grow up to be rich and become president, so can I. It's no longer the province of the elites. Politics is no longer for those of the upper class. If you read Ben Franklin's autobiography, he says, I retired as a printer of 44, and then I entered politics. With Jackson, politics became your profession. Unlike Adams and Jefferson, Lincoln is brought up, and I think this may be in a dissenting sect, and I'm hemming and hawing because, you know, he didn't go to church all that often. Thinking if you went to Monday's Evolution and Wildflowers lecture, right, you get them until the age of 5 or maybe into high school, and then they're done with their religious training. So it is with Lincoln. It was not particularly important to his father. His mother died relatively young. His stepmother was a little more serious about it. All right? So, but this means that he grows up as one of those people that isn't in the dominant denomination strains, that's on the outside, that has not had access to power, and benefited from religious toleration and a lack of a state church. Interestingly, he is the only president not associated with a church or denomination. Two will claim him. Baptists will claim him. Presbyterians will claim him. They claim him. He did not claim them. I don't think most of us see Lincoln as unreligious or irreligious, particularly when we look at, say, the Gettysburg Address or the Second Inaugural Address. But this is important. All right. Yet Lincoln is, with perhaps the exception of Woodrow Wilson, it's a foreshadowing of tomorrow, the one most likely to cite God or the power of God in his public proclamations. Right? We often confuse church going with faith or religiosity. Blinken is a perfect example of why you shouldn't do that. Now, lastly, and I made allusions to this when I talked about John Adams, Lincoln grows up, comes of age, enters politics at a time in which we're beginning to see what historians call Christian nationalism. The notion that America has some preordained, divinely inspired role to play to the world at large. They would point to, you know, John Winthrop's City on a Hill.
There are chairs on the other wall. Yeah, I set them up.
John Winthrop's City on a Hill, they point to the American Revolution, they'd see divinely inspired providence, okay? George Bancroft, who wrote a multi-volume, the first multi-volume history of the United States, and it first published, first volume, 1834, he doesn't finish until 1876, makes this case. And Henry Weems is another historian. But the notion entering the secular literature is that America has some divinely ordained purpose. As Bancroft saw it, as others see it, that purpose is first to conquer North America, to bring those less enlightened people into or underneath our banner. And once we do that, then we can move overseas. Hawaii, all right, the Philippines, Cuba, Europe, the end of World War I, okay? Perhaps Iraq, 2003-2004. Okay? But that what George Bush had tapped into is this long-standing tradition of America, what often is called American exceptionalism. All right? The point I'm trying to make here is that all these things are swirling around Lincoln. America is undergoing a rethinking of itself. And this makes sense, right? A generation after, two generations after the American Revolution, the War of 1812, how do we make sense of where we are? And we ought not to be certain. No. Here's what Lincoln looked like almost all of his life. He was an ugly baby, he was an ugly young man, and he was an ugly presidential candidate. He would never have gotten chosen if it had been TV. Right? He doesn't grow his beard until a young girl writes him a letter after he's been elected president and says, I think you'd look better with a beard. And so he grew the beard from the time he was voted elected until the time he took office. So he is vain, or at least susceptible to young girls telling me, look better.
Aren't we all?
Yes, we are. And the older we get, you know, the more likely. But this is Lincoln for most of his life. Okay? I didn't pick a camp meeting for the second grade awakening. Generally speaking, the first of the campfire revivals begins in 1803 in Kentucky. We say it goes to about 1840, then it begins to fizzle out. That's not what's important. What the Great Awakening does, what does make it important, is for the first time, really, the last time, we can begin to argue that we have a rational relationship with God. The emphasis is on emotion, the feeling, okay? That is, I know I'm saved, therefore I am saved. The kind of very modern notion, at least most of my students come in with, that I can decide that. The focus, and this is where we need to understand, the focus of this relationship is equality before God. It's open access, right? When John Adams was a Calvinist, when John Adams was growing up, you could kind of tell who was getting into heaven by who was rich. All right, now that's not true. Okay? Now think about this for a minute, because it's the next bullet point. Equality in the eyes of God. Does that mean that a slave has the same standing in the eyes of God as the owner? Does my wife have the same rights as God?
Thinking you'll get two different answers on that.
Depends where you are. There's a again, I'll steal it from the Civil War series, right? There's the story about the slave during the Civil War who joins a Union Army, And as he's in camp, his old owner is a captured Confederate soldier. And he looks at him and says, "Master, bottom rail on top now." For us, not only does the question of equality matter, so too do the implications of the Great Awakening. Because what happens is it divides America in ways that we've not seen before. I asked if there were any Baptists in the room. The reason is there's a Northern Baptist and a Southern Baptist. They split in 1844 over, I love this, Jesse Bushyhead's missionary work to the Cherokee Indians. Jesse Bushyhead was a Cherokee Baptist minister who owned a slave. And Northern Baptists said, "We won't fund a missionary going to Cherokee country if he owns slaves." And Southerners said, "What do you mean you won't?" And so the schism that created the two Baptist sects in America has to do with slavery and American Indians. But it's fought by a bunch of white guys. But it also divides America in more obvious ways. Episcopalians, right? Former Anglicans dominate the South. They are slaveholders. Anglicans of New York, those in Pennsylvania, the few that are in New England, they're not. And so what you begin to see is that Southerners, particularly after 1831 and Nat Turner's rebellion, Nat Turner was a slave who was also a slave minister. And his family, his owners, allowed him to move from plantation to plantation along the Great Dismal Swamp, preaching on Sundays. And behold, a white horse will enter and slay the enemy. Well, we know what happened to Nat Turner. I don't want my slaves hearing the promise of the New Testament. And so it becomes illegal for a minister to preach a New Testament text to slaves. It also becomes illegal for a minister to preach to slaves without an overseer or the owner present. So you begin to see a focus on the Old Testament, right? Emphasis on trial, tribulation, acceptance of slavery.
How about the Exodus?
Yeah.
Could they preach the Exodus?
I don't know. They must have, because here's what happens. Slaves begin to identify with the Israelites. And they see themselves, much the same way, right, the Puritans did in New England. They see themselves as the new Israelites. And it's not a coincidence in the early African American post-Civil War literature that Lincoln's first name was Abraham. They saw a clear connection between their deliverance and the Old Testament. What this means is, as we move towards the Civil War, what we see are formerly united groups divided over questions of slavery and preaching from distinctly different parts of the Bible. If this were an 18th century course, I'd tell my students in the 1760s, right, they're speaking the same language, but they don't understand each other. It's like England and America in the 1760s. They just have different conceptions of what the Bible and what to be a good Christian means. And this is problematic because in the 1840s, in the 1850s, the only kind of body, national body, that could bring disparate groups together was the church. The federal government is not large. All right, the single largest expenditure the United States government has up until 1844 was annual presents to the American Indian. That was the single largest expenditure we had every year, living up to treaty rights. What happened in 1844? We begin to prep for war with Mexico, and then we go to war with Mexico, and then we conquer territory bringing God's word to those Californios, and it just goes from there. All right, so I did this just because of the topic. There's no such thing as Lincoln exile, but I think it's a good choice of word, Lincoln's exile. Lincoln, despite everything, is not a successful politician. He is a loser for most of his life. I mean, look at him being married. You know, she was rich, okay? God, I don't know how he didn't end up drinking himself to death. She was a shrew. But I would argue that his failure as a politician is in part due to the Second Great Awakening. Unlike most politicians, as America began to splinter, they began to build ethnic relationships, that is, ethnic voting blocks or religious voting blocks. That is a tried and true method. That is, to be elected, I call upon my congregation, they know who I am, and Lincoln doesn't have one. He doesn't have a natural constituency. And he doesn't because he hasn't, if you will, been moved. And the reason he hasn't been moved is, at least as far as the 1850s is, he's looking for a reasonable God. And the emphasis on emotion, that at least in southern Illinois, when you get these camp meetings and people are falling into stupors and twitches, these would have been signs of the devil 100 years before. But now, and that's not Lincoln, okay? And so he's kind of stuck. He's so stuck that in 1844, when he's running for Congress, his opponent calls him a scoffer. That's another word for atheist. He's a scoffer of religion. Now, this is where Lincoln excels, on the stump. And so the candidate makes this claim, and Lincoln says, I disagree. I am not a scoffer. If my opponent had said that I was skeptical, I would have accepted it and I would have said yes. But I am not a scoffer. Got great cheers. And he won the election. But notice, Lincoln is perceived as somehow irreligious. Now, he opposed war with Mexico. It's a long story. He's responsible for the Point Bill, asking where, in fact, Mexicans had attacked the United States, for which he got drummed out. And he lost office in 1846. And that's the last public election he ran until the Senate debates, until the unofficial, because he's not elected in the Senate. You're chosen by the state Senate, against Stephen Douglas. He does not win another election until the 1860 election. So he's there. What's he going to do? He's going to obviously work as a lawyer. But this is not particularly fun work. It's not particularly easy work. It's the circuit. And it's that circuit that allows him to kind of become, if you will, a person of the people, to kind of understand where they are. In 1850, at the urging of his wife, Mary, he begins reading the Bible. Not like Adams, not like Jefferson. He wasn't a scholar. He wasn't looking for answers. He wasn't trying to find what the earliest version was. He was reading it to converse with those he was defending or those he was prosecuting. Because really, Lincoln made his money as a railroad lawyer, putting out many of the people so that the Illinois Railroad could have access. But it brought him a familiarity. And he attended, and the key is he didn't join a Presbyterian church. So orthodoxy for him, like the others, is problematic. He doesn't go there. And ultimately, this quest for understanding leads Jefferson in a different, Lincoln in a different direction. If Adams and Jefferson had become kind of intellectual Christians, if you will. That is, they sought an intellectual understanding. Lincoln moves towards spiritualism. In understanding that there's, what was Alan's story, I think, was it today? That is, the fact that is larger than the truth. The truth is larger than the fact.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of, I think that would summarize what Lincoln's after. Mm-hmm. That is, it's clear, I can't prove it. You wouldn't look at me and say, oh, it makes sense in the classic sense, but there's something out there that makes me believe. And this will become most obvious in the Civil War. All right, so here's what my blurb said. We're going to look at the Confederates, we're going to look at the Union, we're going to look at God. All right, here's where I, truth in advertising, we'll get through this and then. If America was divided by the Great Awakening, the Civil War divided it even more. Religiously, okay? The fight involved, obviously, the meaning of the Civil War, what it's about. The second thing it involves is God's role in the Civil War, or lack thereof. Now, normally, and we'll just take 2 minutes, I ask my class this. Why did Lincoln save the Union? If you think about it, William Lloyd Garrison, those evangelicals running around saying, oh, thank goodness, let the South go. Let's eliminate the sin of slavery from our government. Let's get rid of them, and now we're closer to God than we were before. The assumption that we make historically is that there had to be a civil war. And that's not true. So before we go further, let's ask ourselves, why does Lincoln decide to resupply Fort Sumter? And then when it's fired upon in April, why does he call for 75,000 volunteers and get this, for 90 days, because it's going to be a short war. Okay? The thinking is that the modern war, the modern material, we can't sustain war for much longer. Okay. So why, what reason might Lincoln, and there are going to be a lot, but I've got one in mind. What reason might Lincoln have for saving the Union?
Save the Union.
But why?
Well, if one group can break away, why can't another group break?
Okay, so we're better whole, is what, can I just paraphrasing, yeah. And it sets precedence. And there's truth to both of these. Any other, look at California. Now, I know everyone here says, let California go. Now, here's the flip side. Californians say, let us go. All right? We are the sixth largest economy in the world. You drain us. All right? So it depends where you sit in the San Andreas Fault. But you're absolutely right. And remember, California, which has all the gold, and we're about to find silver in Nevada, is not yet connected by rail, is not yet attached to the United States proper. And it's that gold and silver which is going to fund the Union Army. And the Confederates are going to be quite interested in trying to get that gold and silver early on. So precedence, but I want to keep it precisely so they don't leave.
The law. One state cannot attack a federal or another state's installation.
Okay. But I argue that I could, right, as a Confederate. But you're saying Lincoln disagrees with that interpretation.
Right.
Yep, okay.
It's the end of American exceptionalism.
Would be the end of American exceptionalism? The key probably, you're all on track, okay, and you're right. There's precedence for the federal government putting down secession, the Hartford Convention, South Carolina nullification. But Lincoln was raised as a Whig, and he idolized Henry Clay. And what Lincoln believed was that individuals had more opportunity together than alone. So that if you think about his understanding, New England mills weave cotton. They spin the cotton. The textile mills, Lowell and Waltham, that travels the Erie Canal, and it gets sold to Midwestern farmers such as his father, who are raising corn. They are sending their corn to the South, where that corn is used in cornmeal for slaves who are making the cotton, which is then sent back to Lowell and Waltham, and the process, you know, this kind of triangular trade, if you will, this regional trade. And Lincoln believes that if the South secedes, it allows a small minority to impose their advantage over the benefit of the whole. That we draw, we have more opportunity, we get better as a society the larger we are. And so he decides to go. He decides to fight. And he has precedents, the Whiskey Rebellion, the Hartford Convention. They're all types of explanations, but this Whig notion, because what he's doing right is he's enlarging the benefits of the system we're in.
Now, I have, in part because I grew up in central Illinois, and so Lincoln is the local deity.
Yep.
So I've read quite a bit of his stuff, not all of it, by any stretch. So when he was a railroad lawyer, this was a big theme of his. Railroad is good, trade is good, for the et cetera. Yep. So I hear all, but where did he say that in, I mean, did that ever, was that ever a public part of his, of the preserving of the Union? Because I haven't seen that.
It is, if you look at like Eric Foner's Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men, it fits, he doesn't, Lincoln is in the emerging Republican. There are liberals, what are called radicals at the time. Those would be the abolitionists that are going to form the Republican Party. There are moderates who believe to a certain degree that some type of compromise can be made. What they would argue, moderates would argue, is slavery divides us. So let's focus on issues such as internal improvements, war with Mexico or Nebraska, or a transcontinental railroad, a homestead act, let's do those. And there are conservatives. And Lincoln is seen as a conservative early on within the Republican Party. That is, it becomes a legalistic argument. Lincoln's great strength, though, is that he can identify with each of those. Lincoln was not supposed to be the Republican candidate in 1860. He was everyone's fourth choice. And after, 24, 25 different ballots, choice number four came of age. And he gets it. Okay? When the war broke out, Northern ministers, and I didn't like this, but Holden has, there's no uniformity, which makes it really ecumenical. But for what I'm trying to do, this was not the best one, but it is better than the Bible study today, because I mistakenly grabbed the Spanish language one. But in chapter 13, verse 1 through 8, and I'm not going to read it all, right, the key point was, you have to submit to authority, to secular authority. All right? Let every soul be subject unto a higher power, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth that power, resisteth the ordinance of God. All right? So the moral crusade in the North is that the government, this is a legitimately constructed government, and in resisting God, in resisting this government, you are resisting God. What does it do? It places the Union and the North on God's side automatically.
Hitler did that.
But I'm not saying, this is not, I have no doubt that Saddam Hussein did it at some point too with Allah, but, it tends. Now, Southern ministers, they argued something different. They began to argue that the U.S. Constitution was agnostic because God is not mentioned in the Constitution. Okay? And so they said what they were doing is actually being Christian. That they were withdrawing from this kind of antagonistic constitution with no conception of God, no mention of God, and we're going to be different. And so I don't have the book with me, I'm sorry. But they wrote, their constitution is exactly the same as the U.S. Constitution, except in two aspects. One, it embeds slavery forever. And two, they have a preamble, which places their safety in God's hands. The phrase was, we invoke God Almighty to protect these Confederate States of America.
How did that work out for them?
You have to ask, right? For the first 2 years, they thought they were working pretty well. Mm-hmm. Right? The reason we issue the Emancipation Proclamation, among other reasons, is precisely because we're losing. And this will prevent England and France from recognizing the Confederate States of America. Mm-hmm. Their abolitionism benefited Lincoln. Mm-hmm. So
are you saying that I'm interested in how slavery did move in Lincoln's mind.
Lincoln,
did that evolve?
William Seward said this. You see, he moves, but he moves slowly. For Lincoln, and for most Northerners, the Civil War was never, ever about slavery. The Civil War is about the extension of slavery into the territories. What they were fighting is a theoretical question. Could you bring slaves, property, right? This was Dred Scott. Slave is property, therefore you cannot exclude it. The way Southerners interpreted Dred Scott, and Northerners as well, is that if it's property, I can take slaves into states which have abolished it and implement it because it's property. It's a theory. Now, Frederick Douglass, from word one, this is a war about slavery. Lincoln, a month before he issues the Emancipation Proclamation, writes, I would do it if I did not fear half my army would put down their arms and half the officers would walk away.
Would do the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah. And is it working? Yeah. Because I'd like it to record. He shows it in August, and his cabinet says you can't do it yet. It will seem a desperate measure. And that's why he has to have the Battle of Antietam in September the 17th, 1862, right? It's a faux victory. That is, I love Longstreet's quote about it. They had every advantage: manpower, munitions, territory. They had one weakness. They brought McClellan, because McClellan was just such a
disaster.
So here it is. I guess invoking the favor and guidance of Almighty God to do ordain and establish this Constitution of the Confederate States of America.
It was a worthwhile gamble, because if they had won, and if God had protected them, that would have re-inscribed slavery, and
it would have altered history.
Yeah, yeah. I think the institution would still exist. To invoke God and then to have won that.
Can I go, though?
Yeah, please.
No, I'm running out of time, and we have to be done. But you're right. It's a great question. But even the South's national motto, right, invoked God's assistance. With God as our defender was their national motto. Right? E pluribus unum is ours. So from the beginning, constitutions were seen as a way to define relationships with God. And if things were different, you're absolutely right. How would we interpret them? Who knows?
Wasn't there a novel on this very point?
Yeah. Historians love counterfactual facts,
yeah.
Right? What I tell my class, because I do want to get to how, is if the South had won, not thinking about slavery, it's very much, most likely, California and Oregon would have gone their own way. And what you would have had, it's likely that Texas likely would have been independent as well, given where it was and what happened in Texas. But we would have looked an awful lot like Europe, is the way. And there's a book, The Six Nations of America. It's kind of a looking at the divisions of America. And there are a number of geographers who predict that by 2050, the United States will not be a nation, that we will, in fact, be a separate set of nations. And the language of today, right, the tearing down of national institutions, the tearing down of civility, the unwillingness to be civil, does not bode well for the nation. Since we are not a nation of a single language, we have never been a nation of a single language, nor of a single religion. And we have very different histories. So the three criteria that Hegel said, or Herder said, you need for a nation, we don't have. All right. So this was the only picture. You can tell Cindy that I tried to get off as quickly as possible. I as did Shelby Foote, I feel guilty that I have this one. Three Confederates at Gettysburg, right? They've been captured, and Shelby Foote talks about it. This does represent the South in a way that few other pictures do. You have probably heard, I hope, of Drew Gilpin Faust. She's the president of Harvard. She has written a wonderful book called This Republic of Suffering. I would encourage, I thought my students were going to hate it. It is the most depressing book I have read in a long time. They loved it. And they loved it for a couple of reasons. The Civil War, and really the bloodiness of the Civil War, an average battle of the Civil War, average casualties of somewhere between 18 and 28%. At the end of Gettysburg, Lee's train of wounded stretched 23 miles. And, you know, we've got another 2 years of battle to go. So how did it change? Well, among the questions that emerge, certainly among troops and family, is what happens when you die away from home? Up until the Civil War, 95% of Americans died at home. They died in their home with spouse, children, parents, whoever, around. And this had given death in America a particular sense. It was a familial affair. You never really died alone. What happens to that soldier who has his thigh broken because of shrapnel and is left in a battlefield in what ultimately World War I be called no man's land? Or in Andersonville or someplace. So what happens? We have to reconfigure the meaning of death. What happens if you can't find the deceased? At the Battle of Antietam, right, they marched through the Union troops marched through the cornfield, and Stonewall Jackson sees them coming, and so they line shrapnel up, and they blow 30 cannon, and you can fire a cannon once every 20 seconds. And they let these cannon go. And as one of the soldiers said, it was like wheat before the scythe. But more than that, some of those men didn't just get cut in half. The top half disappeared. Now remember, you're not wearing, you don't have a dog tag. You don't have really anything to identify you. When I get back and we call reveille, we find who's there. At the end of the battle, we may be able to send people out to kind of get the dead, gather the dead. But I'm grabbing legs. Whose? By the end of the war, soldiers on both sides were writing their names on a piece of paper and taking a straight pen and putting it on the back so that if they found the shirt, they would be identified. Claire Barton, right, the founder of nursing in America, she spent the next 10 years after the Civil War simply trying to identify and locate deceased relatives who were unaccounted for, to bring closure to the families. What happens to someone if there's no proper burial? Alan again talked about this, right? With the sin or the shame of suicide. A church says no. I immediately thought of Goethe's The Sorrows of Young Werther, where he says, right, no priest would attend the funeral because he had committed suicide. Are you going to heaven if a comrade buries you? Or at the Battle of Shiloh, where you dig a pit and you throw them in it, and you simply write, here lie 23 rebels. Is that proper Christian burial? So these are some, and to go back to what we started with, right? What happens to marriage in death? Okay, most people, not all people, that got married before, right, had two arms, two legs. For the most part, they were sane. You kind of knew what they looked like. Do limbs grow back in heaven? Can't hear. If the idea before was the body that you have is the body that you're going to take with you. All right? This is not unique to Christianity. This is not unique to America, right? This is why Native Americans always sliced the knuckle of the forefinger off their enemy. That way they wouldn't be able to shoot a bow in the next life, and they'd go hungry. All right, so it's not unique to this notion. But will Johnny, who went to be a soldier, right, will he have two arms, two legs? Now, this is not a moot point. Hood, John Hood, right, the defender of Atlanta. By the time he got to Atlanta, both arms had been shot off and one leg. It's kind of like Monty Python, you know? They had to be strapped in there, and he held. He's such a good horseback rider, he put the reins between his fanny cheeks, right? But who wants to remain, you know, fortunately for his wife, he dies in the yellow fever epidemic, and she'll have to confront that, and they've made decisions. But is this really the husband I'm going to have in the afterlife? And so we begin to get rethinking, what does it mean to be, to get into heaven? How do I get into heaven? What do I do? And these questions are inter-core religious. They have to do with how we see our coming to the Christ or to God. And probably no one, Walt Whitman says, struggled with these questions more than Lincoln. Walt Whitman tells stories, right, the Washington Capitol's not yet complete. They're just building the dome. And Walt Whitman says, on many a night, I ran across the president, and soon we began to converse. And he says to me, I often come here and look up, because it gives me hope that we're not yet done, and there's so much more to do. So Lincoln begins not thinking this is a war about slavery, not really thinking about how this might affect faith and questions of faith or God. But he begins to grasp the larger issues. And one of the things that makes Lincoln unique is he does grow. He doesn't grow. If Adams has enjoyed the most revision, Lincoln is not doing very well these days. When you leave Holden, go check the New York Times bestseller list. Because there's a new book, it's historical fiction, but it's based upon real events called The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln. And it's an argument that Lincoln should be tried because he did not do enough to free the slave. He did not take into effect or into account what the war was about till too late. That is, he could have done more. So Lincoln, and Barbara Fields hates him, and the, so Lincoln hasn't done as well as you might think. What Lincoln is trying to come to grips with when he thinks about faith, when he thinks about God, is the enormous cost in lives. Right? He lost a son. His wife lost three brothers. Of course, they were Confederates, and so there's much rejoicing on the North Side. There was much criticism of Lincoln because he had married, obviously, this Southern sympathizer. But there really wasn't a family that did not deal with this. Nearly 25% of all American men are going to participate in some way in this war. It's enormous. And he begins searching for meaning. And if I'd been smart, we would have read some Walt Whitman, because Walt Whitman has some really wonderful Civil War poems. They are I'm not a big poetry fan for the most part, but these really are moving. And so Lincoln begins to make this war, which ministers have seen as kind of religious from the beginning, Lincoln begins in 1863 to make this connection between what we're enduring in the Civil War and some larger event. And we're going to look at two, okay? How he sees God, I would argue, is seen lots of places, but the most famous place is his second inaugural address. And for those that don't know, John Wilkes Booth is in the picture that you see of Lincoln as he's about to give his speech. John Wilkes Booth is two rows up and two to his right. He is there. Though there were sharpshooters on the lawn and on the buildings, it is quite likely that if Wilkes had chosen that moment, he could have shot Lincoln there. Right? There were very few Secret Service at the time. All right, so here's the Gettysburg Address. We don't have time to go through it all. But remember two things about this. Lincoln did not think it was a good speech. He told his best friend, if I remember, that speech didn't scout. That is, it didn't clean. It didn't go well. It didn't clean like the furrow of a plow. And the press hated it. One, the London Times, excuse me, said, America ought to be embarrassed. It was so short, the cameraman did not get a picture of Lincoln giving the speech. It's only 250 words, right? It's 2 minutes. We do have he's just getting ready to sit down behind the lens. He tried, the cameraman to his credit tried. But look what he's saying, right? 47 years our fathers brought forth on this continent and a nation. Here's where that Christian nationalism comes in. Conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So now he's beginning to argue that this is a war about slavery.
And there's nothing in the Constitution about all that. He's stealing from the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
That's no legal authority.
Right. Well, it didn't. The Emancipation Proclamation, this just shows Lincoln's conservatism.
Exactly.
He argued that you couldn't free slaves when the Constitution continued to exist. So Kentucky, Delaware, Maryland, and West Virginia were allowed to keep their slaves. And they had to vote separately to abolish slavery. So too, a second Emancipation Proclamation had to be issued for the New Mexico Territory for American Indians. Because the Hopi and Navajo were busy stealing each other and making them, selling them as slaves. And since they weren't technically citizens of the United States, the question emerged, were they obligated to adhere to it? And so in 1867, another proclamation was issued. But here we begin to see it, now engaged in this great Civil War, testing. But this is right. In a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot concentrate. Now, the soil, it reeked. When he read this in November, the soil was still leaching the gases from the dead bodies. Okay? You could literally watch the ground bubble. So when he's speaking, they're smelling. All right? Consecrate. We cannot hallow this ground. The brave men living and dead who struggled here have consecrated far above our poor power to add or detect. And it goes on, which turns out to be false. And then he says, right, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Look what he hasn't said. He has not mentioned the nation America or the United States. A nation so dedicated. What he's done is placed the American experience, what America is doing, in a much larger context. We have, right, the Mexicans fighting Maximilian in Mexico. The battle, we all celebrate Cinco de Mayo wrongly, but we celebrate it for the victory at the Battle of Puebla. And what Lincoln is saying, right, is that we are doing this not for us alone, but for the world at large. The revolutions of 1848 had failed in the most part, in Germany, in Prussia, in France. We have a dictator, Napoleon. What he's saying is American exceptionalism is alight. It is kind of going. But that we're doing this in a large measure with God. Okay? And I don't want to hear that we're doing this for others. I want to know that Johnny, there's a reason why Johnny did this. And this is one of the reasons why it didn't. Now, the main speaker, I forget the guy, William Howell. Very famous orator. He spoke for 3 hours at Gettysburg. Okay? He spoke before Lincoln. Howell sent Lincoln a note, said, Mr. President, I wish I could have done what you did as well as you did. All right, so the expert looked and said, this is great. Okay, so here's the second inaugural.
Mike, I can't resist kibitzing. If people, I can't recommend highly enough a book about Lincoln to get called Lincoln at Gettysburg.
The McPherson book.
No, the Gary Wills book.
Oh, okay, that's right. That's right.
So it's fantastic, all about Lincoln at Gettysburg and the sources of the speech and what it did and didn't do and the reactions and howls.
And Wills is a great historian on that subject. All right, so this kind of goes back, I think, Carrie, to me, right? This is what Lincoln says in his inaugural address. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any man should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not, that we not be judged. Here you see that kind of reading that he did. He doesn't cite scripture, right? He says, this is one we can know. All right? The prayers of both could not be answered. So God is going to choose sides eventually. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. And then he says, and I didn't highlight it, right? Woe unto us. Woe unto us. We are wreaking the sin of slavery. Now, for those who don't know, slavery accounted for 3/4 of American export profits in the years before the Civil War. That was our high tech. That was our sole export.
Cotton.
That he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came. Shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? And as was said 3,000 years ago, still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and just altogether. Now it ends with malice towards none and charity toward all, the firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right. Let us strive to finish. Now Lincoln's great, and this sounds so horrible, I don't mean it to sound horrible at all, okay? Lincoln's assassination saved him from the struggles of Reconstruction. And would his charity, his kind of kindness, have continued in light of how the South responded? We don't know. We'll never know. But the indications pretty early were that he was interested in binding the wounds as closely together. But what Lincoln has done, right, is he's seen in this war God's hand. And it's not always pretty. But he's also come to believe somehow that America is divinely ordained. And maybe as a Christian, maybe from some other place, the South need not be pushed aside forever because of this error. That is, you're not always punished. That there must be a way, because how did he see the Union as benefiting everybody? And so Lincoln comes of age, if you will, religiously, as a result of the Civil War, by trying to answer these questions. But notice what he didn't do, and I just thought of this, and like Adams and like Jefferson, he's not relied, or he's not asked for the intervention of the Christ. He's relied, he's appealed directly to God. Now, he's not a Unitarian. Don't make that mistake. Okay? He's not any... But again, perhaps this was a legacy of the Second Great Awakening, where he saw how orthodoxy had divided. And by appealing to God, Jews, dissenting denominations, Catholics, and all could say, all right, we'll never know. We'll never know. But what we have then in Lincoln is someone who clearly sees God's hand, who believes God is acting in the here and now, is trying to understand how God's acting in the here and now without falling into orthodoxy, without saying it's this way or no other way. And this is what we would expect, right, from leaders, from ministers, from others. Growth in acknowledgement. I think one of the great strengths that Alan Story has shown many of us, right, is where we wrestle. Where we wrestle with understanding. And in a sense, that's what Lincoln represents. He comes to believe that he's on the side of right. He comes to believe that he's doing God's work. He comes to believe that the nation will emerge better, if for no other than slavery's end. But those that follow Lincoln, particularly members of the Grand Army of the Republic, they're not interested in the future of the African American. They're not interested in how the war changed the nation. What they're interested in, and remember I told you on Monday, this is my area of research right now, what the Grand Army of the Republic is interested in is being considered the saviors of the Union as they define it. They want to tell you what the meaning of the Civil War was. And so they began to write the histories that make Lincoln this religious martyr as opposed to a religious thinker on questions. And that has some profound implications, some of which deal with Wilson, but most do not. So I've gone 5 minutes over, I apologize. If you have some questions, we certainly have 5 or 6 minutes. If you don't, go get a seat so you don't have to sit in the back where it gets hot. Or on the far side to get your ice cream early. But thank you.